Rasha, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Awesome. I hear you too. Good. And you guys hear me fine. I don't sound weird.
No, you sound fine.
My microphone isn't. Okay, cool. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been nervous about this episode because I've been trying to prepare my notes, and then after I wrote them all down, I realized they're all scattered, and I'm like, oh shit, where do I start now? You know?
That's better than me. I couldn't even remember the topic. I totally forgot.
Well, today's topic, Doc, is Easter bunnies.
Oh, right
I
on.
don't know if you remember where we were.
I mean, yeah, I hear they're interesting to look for.
I want to be more professional this time around with my how I present, with how I introduce and how I structure, but I don't think that's going to work out. I think I'm just going to be chaotic like I always am, but I'm going to try. Hello, everybody. Today is March 24th, 2024. This is Colonial Outcast, your friendly neighborhood anti-imperialist, anti-war, pro-Palestinian, pro-Jewish, and anti-propaganda podcast that endeavors to bring you unmatched customer satisfaction. My Muslim fam, Ramadan Kareem. For my Jewish fam, Hag Sameach, Happy Purim. And for my fellow Christians, Happy Palm Sunday. So today, three holidays of the three Abrahamic religions happen to align. It's not rare, but it makes an ironic day for this episode. Joining me today is my friend Rashi, who is second-generation Palestinian-American, whose parents both immigrated to the U.S. in the late 70s. Her grandparents survived the Nakba. She was able to visit Palestine for the first time last year, which we'll talk about. And our returning crowd favorite, writer, historian, and professor of history, Dr. Liam O'Mara, who hosts his own YouTube channel called, get ready for it, Office Hours with the Mad Professor, not After Hours with the Mad Professor, Office Hours with the Mad Professor. So I just want to make that very clear. For those of you who don't know, the last episode I had with him, I said After Hours with the Mad Professor. So I did it at the beginning, and I did it at the end. So that just shows you how professional I am as a podcaster, messing up the name of the shows that my guests host in their separate channels. So I really wanted Rashi on this episode because so far we've only had guests who have some kind of prominent online presence. Rashi does not. She has a very humble presence online, has very little public visibility. Nonetheless, she has been very pivotal in the Palestinian movement. Also, it was her who gave me safe passage into joining this pro-Palestinian movement. I have to credit that to her. I've always been nervous about joining any type of activism because I often feel, I feel rough around, too rough around the edges for most people. I feel too brash. I've always felt intimidated because there are a lot of gatekeepers in these types of movements who kind of critique to a pedantic level people who want to join. I am not an eloquent guy. I'm definitely not intelligent, especially compared to someone like Greg Stoker, who's been in this type of realm for a while. He's very articulate. He's very well refined. And so not everybody's like that. There you got people like me, rednecks, who are dumb as shit, but they want to voice their opinion. They want to speak from the heart. They want to tackle topics that are normally very sensitive and are full with landmines and pitfalls. But nonetheless, you know, Rashi was there to create that bridge for me to cross over into this realm. And ironically, me and her both found Dr. O'Mara separately on his lives. I don't know who found him first, if it was you or me, Rashi. One of us found him, and we both were big fans. Rashi's a big fan of Dr. O'Mara. We just love, you know, sneaking on your lives in the shadows and just, you know, learning. So Dr. O'Mara is a returning guest, an audience favorite. He's a history professor, writer, and historian, also ran for the House of Representatives in California's 42nd Congressional District. Doc, you're not just a favorite because of your vast knowledge of history and geopolitical analyses and perspective, but also simply because of your empathetic nature and genuine concern for humanity. It spews out of every pore of your skin, and the audience can feel that. This kind of empathy combined with such a degree of intelligence and knowledge has earned you the respect of thousands who watch and engage with your TikTok lives, where I and Rashi were lucky enough to meet you and learn. And for those of you who hate it when I'm the exclusive host, in my co-host Greg's absence, I completely understand. I don't like hearing my bumbling ass talk either. And for those who are new to this podcast, it was conceived by Greg Stoker and myself back in October, but only materialized over a month ago, with our first guest being Dr. Omara. Greg is a former Army Ranger who worked in an intelligence capacity for special operations in Afghanistan. Not too long after, he turned into an anti-war activist, reminiscent of the anti-war vets of Vietnam that he often conjures up as shining examples for future activism. He's not with us today, but is definitely invested in this topic and episode. This is also going to be another academic marathon, not a quick 40-minute sprint. We realize that some in our audience absolutely hate long-form episodes and prefer short and sweet TV dinners. And then there are those who absolutely love diving deep into long academic journeys, so we probably will wind up breaking this up into a two-parter. Now, there may be a lot of redundancy in these episodes that our returning viewers may already be familiar with, but we also have new listeners who may be fresh to this podcast, the host and the guest. So I often reiterate a lot of things that have been said multiple times in previous episodes. Now, I want to make it clear to the audience that my views and the views of the guests do not necessarily represent or reflect on Greg's views. We have to understand that Greg and I are two different people. We have two different opinions and outlooks. We overlap on just about most of the important things, but there are differences. For example, I'm religious. He's not. I'm more of a speculator. I'm definitely the conspiracy theorist amongst him and I, but Greg is definitely the type of guy who only deals with the facts that are right in front of him. So that's the difference between the two. We're two separate human beings with two separate lives, two separate backgrounds. So I do not want anything said in these podcasts to be construed as being a overall complete reflection of Greg himself, and vice versa. That goes for Greg as well. And I think, you know, we're all adults. We all know that, but sometimes it can get confusing. That's up to the audience to make that discernment, in my opinion. Today's episode, the center of gravity is going to be around Islamophobia. Its history, its evolution in the modern era, its relationship with anti-Semitism, and of course, its relevance to the current genocide that's taking place against some of the most beautiful and badass human beings known as Palestinians. So with that, Doc, I wanted you to get to know Rashi a little bit. She's a huge fan, loves your lives, and me and her used to talk about you and share our opinions about a particular talking point you've made in the past. We've often used you as a reference when arguing with people on the pro-Israeli side and Zionist. So you've been definitely like the bullets in our AK-47 banana clip sometimes. So if that makes sense, that's intellectually, you've been a big ally of Muslims, and we're all a fan. And I think find it fitting that she be on this for sure, because she's, the way I view Rashi is she is a typical American mom. She's a typical American mom. She deals with the same struggles that every American mom in the Midwest does. And so I want, for the audience that maybe doesn't know too much about Islam, I'm trying to normalize Muslim mothers in this country, because she is about as typical as you can get. And honestly, Rashi, I see a little redneck in you. Redneck. I mean, I see a little redneck. You may not see a little redneck in you, but I can hear it sometimes. So that's another thing about you. So anyways, I'll let you guys, let you express how you've gotten to know Dr. Liam O'Mara and his lives.
Yeah. So I kind of just stumbled upon him on Dr. O'Mara on TikTok, like you said. And I was just super intrigued by sort of like your wealth of knowledge on everything. Like, you're like an encyclopedia, from like religion to Palestine. And sometimes I'm like, I just want to sit here and watch and take notes. So like you said, I can just use them on other people because you just have so much information. So, yeah, I'm super excited to be able to speak to you.
No, thanks. I appreciate that. It's, There will be fewer people finding me accidentally because of the way the shadow bans work. I don't show up in the whole like for you stuff at all anymore on TikTok. So, it's definitely slowed down a lot. But yeah, it's just fun to engage with people to see the kinds of things that they're worried about, wondering about, the kinds of the thoughts or questions people have, and I'll just contribute what little I can where I can to those discussions. But I'm always interested in seeing, you know, what's of interest to people, what's topical, what's bugging people.
Yeah. Well, obviously, I think all of us in the movement have been in going through extreme depression on just what we're seeing happen out of Gaza. We've argued ourselves to death. We've debated to death against people on the other side of the fence on this topic. And at this point, we're just kind of like, look, it's beyond debate. Obviously, it's now affecting our, obviously, you know, it's affecting our personal lives and our mental health. But I find that to be extremely natural during a genocide. I think it's very unnatural for us as a society just to move on like life is normal when you have something like this going on. I think we need to normalize being depressed about what's happening in Gaza. It's a reality. We need to feel it. We're part of humanity. All of us are part of this world. So pull that switch off and pretend that it's not going on, you're kind of switching off from humanity. Like we're setting such a terrible precedent. You know, by like we see it on TV, we see politicians just laughing, having a great time, making jokes, really just shrugging this off and gaslighting the public while there's kids with limbs, you know, blown off, crawling on the street, mothers not able to feed their children. Just the worst of the worst that you've ever seen on phone, on 2K, you know, in 4K. We cannot let that normalization happen. And that's what the movement has been really going through, is struggling to remind people this is not normal. It goes against nature. It goes against nature itself, what's happening. So it's, you know, I see it in people's faces, people who, you know, at the beginning, you know, since October, maybe they had a lot of energy, but now I see that I see them drained emotionally, and I completely understand. So, you know, for the audience, I want you guys to understand that it is extremely normal to be depressed about this. Make sure you're taking care of your mental health. Do what you have to do to stay in the fight. You know, if it takes taking a leave of absence and clearing out that mental space so that you can come back refreshed in the movement, do that. Do whatever it takes to stay in the fight. That's all I got to say. Do not let the shadow banning intimidate you. Do not let the, you know, bullying intimidate you. Do not let the gaslighting, you know, put out your flame. Do what you have to do to stay in the fight. Do whatever it takes, mentally, spiritually, whatever. And I think today's episode on is, you know, we're going to be talking about Islam. And I think it plays a major role in that mental health part of it, especially. I'm going to kick this off with the story, if you two don't mind, a personal story, you know, and I'm going to try to make my way through it. I wanted to write down a monologue, but I think I'm just going to wing it, you know, this personal story. So once upon a time, there was a young man, American, grew up on military bases his whole life, grew up around patriotism, the evangelical Christian community. His dad was a pastor in the military, known as a chaplain, surrounded by all the typical doctrines you hear in churches. This young man grew up in Christian schools most of his life, private Christian schools, always taught the Bible, and definitely taught history from a white supremacist, subtle white supremacist slant to it. Now, 2001, we had an attack on September 11th. And of course, the world was inflamed with all kinds of different emotions and sentiments. Chief among those sentiments was Islamophobia. Now, this Islamophobia did not just remain on the political, public sphere or the geopolitical sphere. It trickled down into institutions such as churches, Christian churches, especially in the United States. This sentiment was so ingrained in American culture that churches would have entire days, entire services dedicated to the conspiracy theory that Muslims and Islam is trying to conquer the world in a demonic horde of imams and converts, that they convert people with the sword. So a young man was witnessing all of this, all these teachings, and soaked every bit of it up. After all, this was a pastor talking. This is a man of the Bible talking, so he must know. So, and also at the same time, pro-Israeli sentiment was also arising. This country, the ancient Israelites, have now formed a country in 1948, and they are here to help us, join us with the Christian nations in a crusade against this evil horde known as Islam. So during this time period, the young man would study the ancient prophetic texts, eschatology of Revelations, and go to church and soak the different little facts that the pastor was preaching about how this relates to end times prophecies. Now, while this was going on, this young man was attending his first public high school. He had left the private Christian network, left the military school system, and is now in his first public high school in Bonner Springs, Kansas. Now, during this time of Islamophobia, thankfully, our public school systems thought it necessary to allow Muslims to come to schools and educate people on Islam and why they are not a threat. This young man did not. He was going to use this opportunity to really stick it to the Muslims. It was his first opportunity to meet a Muslim. So what did he do? He took a blank white t-shirt and spray painted the Israeli flag on the back of it, showed up to school, showed up to this class, which was held in a very intimate kind of small, intimate setting where students would sit down, and this young Muslim lady, very respectful, would come and teach the class about Islam. This young man saw it as an opportunity to get his first shot in to a Muslim. So he sat there and disrespectfully interrupted her and asked her about her religion and different things that he had heard about it. For example, is it true that such and such? Is it true that your prophet did such and such? Is it true that your prophet taught such and such? Is it true that you hate so and so? And he hounded her very disrespectfully. He left that classroom with an arrogance and a pride. And that lady, despite being hounded by this young man, was very respectful. She patiently bit her tongue and tried her best to get past this badgering. That young man was me. That 14-year-old man grew up to be the man, the bald dude, the old, over-the-hill guy that you see on the camera before you. I would then go on to travel to Jerusalem with the thoughts of joining the IDF, with the thoughts of being the most, pro-Israeli dude on the planet. As fate would have it, the first friends I made in Jerusalem, due to the fact that they assigned me to a certain dorm floor, my first friends would be Palestinian Muslims. And after about a couple hours of arguing, smoking hookah, eating hummus, countless packs of cigarettes, I realized that my closest friends in the world would wind up being Muslims. I would come to learn that Islam would be the gateway for my walk as a Christian, becoming closer to this rabbi we know as Yeshua. And I would find that it would be the Palestinian Muslims that would help bring me to that place in my life where I felt like I could touch the ancient past that I once learned about in church. So I wanted to open this whole topic up with that story because I find it to be a very good example of the effects of Islamophobia and how one can leave it. It's how one could finally break free from it by simply learning, you know, by simply being around people who know about Islam, who are Muslim. And I have a lot of things to say about Islam, how it's helped me become a better Christian, how it's helped me become a better person. The man you see before me was, I am the man you see before me because of Palestinian Muslims. At the age of 18, I was learning about the world. This is my first time away from my family on my own in another country, straight out of high school. I had never seen anything traumatic in my life. There's so much I didn't know. And it was Palestinian Muslims who helped open my eyes to how beautiful this world can be if you can learn to appreciate different religions that are not your own, different belief systems. And then sometimes you'll take from those belief systems and make them your own. There is so much I have taken from Islam and incorporated into my own life. So you see the stark contrast. And sorry, guys, I was trying to work my way through that. It was pretty hard. I didn't really know how to put into words. But anyways, you saw the man that I was. And you see the man that I am now. And how I got there is a long story, but I guess this episode we're going to be focusing on how did I wind up in that situation in the first place at age 14? What history led to this, you know, stupid ideology that seems to be constantly popping back up and then disappearing and then flaring up again? There's a long history of that, and we're going to get into it. And we're also going to get into, you know, probably even a more disturbing story from stories from Rashi, who is Muslim and lives as a typical American, nonetheless, with the addition of being Muslim, also with the addition of being Palestinian. So, let's get into that. So I don't know how we should break into this, Doc. Think we should start?
Honestly, there's a bit of an anecdote I can tack on here that I think might go well with a lot of your connection stuff. Because you said something earlier that I found really interesting, because it still kind of surprises me when people describe me as empathetic. As I've always been very open to people, I could care about issues, but I really don't relate well to people. And I had a very different kind of experience around the 01, event that you were describing, because for me, the hard part about that was never the difference, the Muslims as people or Islam as a different religion or something, because I was always much more easily sucked into a world of books and knowledge and struggled to understand people. So where I was at that time was actually working in a small aerospace startup in Long Beach. And a lot of the people working on our project there, which was a little, turboprop pusher with the canard, and it was a neat looking little plane, but they came largely out of, the bigger defense contractors that were in the area, Douglas that became Boeing, and then, all this, Lockheed Martin, all that kind of crap, they were in a lot of these big defense contractors. So they're surrounded by that kind of, pro-military sort of perspectives on a lot of issues. And when this happened, you saw that chunk of legislation they rammed through very quickly, because they already had all these ideas that became the USA Patriot Act. And I was offended not only by that, but by tons of the attitudes that I heard justifying it to people. And I struggled in two ways with that. One was, why do you feel this way about people? Because no one was going around talking about, like, I don't know, the Klan or your like McVeighs or whatever as like somehow emblematic of like Christians, but yet you're pointing to a particular violent movement and saying this is Muslims and we have to be afraid of Muslims. And I'm like, where the fuck does that come from? And all I'm doing is I'm like connecting it back to all these past periods of like, you know, phobia and traumas, you know, like, you know, crusades, all this weird shit. And like, how the fuck are we still dealing with this crap at the beginning of the 21st century? What is wrong with you people? And I had a hard time with it because I tried to attack it in a different way. I said, well, let's look at what your fear is leading to. So again, given I'm working at this company, I printed out Patriot Act, highlighted a bunch of sections, and went down and sat down with different people that I did respect as humans, because these were people that the way we kind of divided up, I was in IT at the time. And I spent a lot more time supporting the engineers, and a partner spent a lot more time supporting the manufacturing floor. So I'm hanging out with these engineers, and these are people with, you know, advanced degrees, and I figured, well, they're not going to be idiots, right? So I'm sitting there showing them, like, do you see these lines? Do you see what this will do? Do you see what power this gives to the government? Why do you want to do that? Because while you think it maybe is targeting a particular group that you're scared of now, this can easily target other groups, other people, including you. And everybody, I didn't find a single one of these people that were worried about it at all because they were so terrified of Muslims. It's like some kind of existential terror, like you're suddenly expecting, hordes, you know, like
just come in your front door
or something. Like, yeah, we're going to fuck around, destroy the Christian world. And it's just, it was a really interesting moment for me because, like I said, I've always struggled more with the people side of it, with the direct relating with humans. And I was just shocked at this psychology, and it really got me much more interested in the psychology of extremism, because here on the one hand, not only do we need to understand why would groups like Al-Qaeda do what they're doing, you know, why do they adopt certain tactics? Because you get why they would resist certain issues, obviously anti-imperialist podcast, but why would they do it in particular ways? Why would they go after civilians? Why would, you know, why do people set off, you know, bombs in opposing mosques or something? Like, you know, so they're not only let's study this particular form of Islamism, but the fact that you're confronting it with exactly the same kind of like extremist psychology, you know, and then people fall into their opposing camps on this and they think that they're like totally normal. And it kind of got me to finally accept that it is kind of normal to react that way, that there is something human about it. But it sent me off into a couple of decades of reading about, you know, evolutionary anthropology, evolutionary psychology, you know, the all the different instincts that drive us, as well as connecting that to all the rest of this shit about the different ideologies and circumstances that bring out extremism, because it's the same thing. The kind of stuff that you're describing, the kind of reflexive hatred that shows up there, is what everyone always points to. That's the bad guys. They think about us. Ah, Islamofascists. They're very narrow minded. They just want to like kill. And then it's exactly the same kind of narrowness. You know, it's a kind of extreme that people get sucked into.
Yeah.
And I found it frankly terrifying that I was surrounded by that was just normalized, that people could be spouting this kind of hatred. And you see it again now with tons of younger people that are being woken up to this stuff by the Palestine issue, because they're seeing footage of someone driving a military bulldozer through a cemetery and cheering that they're just destroying someone's, like, you know, life and heritage. And they're like, yeah, it serves them right. Fuck them. You know, I'm like, what? I understand where the depression comes from too. You know, it's cause it's hard to look around and realize that all these people around you that you think are just normal everyday people have this potential to, at the drop of a hat, become extremely violent extremists who will justify any number of atrocities. You know, if you're ever wondering what how these terrible moments in human history can happen. Like, I don't know, what would you do if you were in the 30s in Germany or something? You know, how would you have responded to the rise of this extremism? You know, well, we're seeing it all the time. It makes sense why it would happen. People are always wondering, well, how could that happen? How could this whole country go insane? Well, if you actually slow it down and think about it, it happens over and over and over again. That kind of collective insanity, you know, that you see in the 30s there, the same thing in the aughts in the US, a kind of collective insanity, terrified of Muslims.
I think that's what a lot of us are going through right now, especially on the pro-Palestinian side, is that we're all kind of shocked to see people, the world around us, turn sociopathic so easily. Like the way that we see some people talk about what's happening in Gaza is like, well, you know, they put Hamas in power. So, one of the worst ones is, well, if you think about it, these kids are probably going to grow up to be terrorists. I'm like, oh my God. And what's crazy is that the detachment that Christians have completely taken from the teachings of their own Lord, the very teachings of Jesus saying, you know, love thy neighbor. And even if they're your enemy, even if they are your enemy, which the Gazans are not our enemy, but even if they were, he says, love your enemy.
Love your enemy, turn the other cheek.
Love your enemy. So turning the other cheek. And obviously they're not even our enemy. They're the opposite of our enemy. They're great people. They're amazing people. So you have this detachment from not only, you know, from people's humanity and compassion, but also from their own faith, and trying to twist themselves in a spiritual and moral pretzel to justify it. And they'll go any which way to do it, you know, any which way. I mean, the words of Jesus saying that he who causes any child to stumble, basically anybody who would harm a child, it would be better that a millstone be wrapped around their neck and then be tossed to the sea. Basically saying that harming a child is the worst thing you could ever do, is the point he was trying to get across. And we literally have Christians saying that, well, these kids should probably die because they would become terrorists. Like, that's how insane it's gotten. And so, like you said, we look back at points in history of insanity, you know, and you can just pick one, you know, you got the Holocaust, that's just one of them, but you have tons of other ones, the annihilation of the Native Americans, the witch trials.
Yeah.
You know, the Salem witch trials, stuff like that. We look back like, oh, that's insane.
Over and over again, you have people turning on some kind of perceived other, regardless of whatever evidence. It's interesting that you mentioned turning away from Christianity, because I and this is something we can get into more detail on later, but I have a very complicated view of that, especially since over and over again, we've seen Christians being Christian, ignoring all those passages and justifying whatever atrocities they want, you know, and you don't have to go back to the Crusades for that kind of shit. I mean, just look at the Klan of the 20s or the Klan of the 60s, you know, that, or even the again, the Yahtzees, TikTok language, the Nazis, you know, they're thinking about it.
You have the TikTok
in your head, you know, but like a lot of them were quite sincerely religious, you know, and, so it's not, The trick here is that we tend to think of religion as this distinct body of knowledge, and that people are going to think about all the ideas in it and read the text, and they're going to internalize what Jesus or whatever you're following says, and that actually motivates their behavior. But most of our behavior has nothing to do with that at all. It's much more the social relations, the kind of tribal identity we have. So Christians have a proven capacity for horrific violence and for ignoring completely those teachings, because the identity is the thing primarily motivating them, not the scripture. And it creates this interesting disconnect. So there are plenty of evangelicals that are like, what the hell's wrong with you? But a majority of evangelicals are literally white supremacists and genuinely horrific, you know, a lot of their basic beliefs. But they both point to the same book and say, this book is important to us. But they're reading it very differently. But I think when we get caught up in the readings themselves, we're missing the point, because it's really not about those texts. It's about the identity people have. You know, it shouldn't be surprising to people, but it is when you have all these people today saying, well, this that Jesus guy sounds way too woke, but they're super Christian. Like they deliberately turn down the ideas that the churches themselves have historically been able to point to and say, this is bullshit, but they'll still identify as Christians. It's tackling that. We shouldn't tackle it on a kind of scriptural or theological basis in a way, because it's really an emotional and social issue. It's the way people get caught up in certain groupthink identities that, somehow, and again, you can see this all through our history, religions don't actually prevent it. But people within systems tend to think that, like, oh, well, no real Muslim would do this. No real Christian would do this. Well, no, simple fact is they would. Like, they do. Like, you, if you're thinking about the religion properly, no, you're not going to, maybe. But people within these systems have always been able to act this way.
And honestly, in some type of ways, Christianity talks about that as well. When Jesus said that the path to the kingdom of heaven is narrow and very few find it, and the path to destruction is very broad. I think that has a lot of layers to that statement. I think the statement goes is that if you truly are going to follow the path, under this rabbi we call Yeshua, then it requires going down a path away from tribalism, away from all those social pressures. It's the same as Buddhism. If you're going to follow the path of Buddhism, we obviously know that Buddhism is not like everybody who's a Buddhist. We see what's happening in Myanmar and Sri Lanka. We know that them just being Buddhist. I mean, imagine if everybody in Sri Lanka was actually following Buddhism. We wouldn't have had this terrible atrocity we had over a decade ago. I'll say in the sense that, look, I believe that religion can be a safety measure that prevents our society from going that way. But again, it's like the not a true Scotsman fallacy. It's like that can always play a role too in allowing these things to happen.
Yeah, for sure. I'd say for particular people, it can be very helpful. I don't think that the religions themselves can ever truly insulate us from this kind of stuff. We have to look a little bit deeper than it, because there's something more in just the basic social relations and in the kind of social ideals that pass around that end up overriding a lot of the impulses. So I'm glad you brought up there are like Hindu suicide bombers and Buddhists committing genocide. And the most significant terrorist group in the world is actually a Christian one in terms of the body count. I mean, there's every religion has this proven capacity for violence, but yet they're all contradicting it. So you mentioned the criticism of tribalism that you can see with, with Yeshu ben Yosef, AKA Jesus Christ. What the hell is the Good Samaritan story about? But like, don't judge a person by their background. This is a competing religion that Jews were raised to hate, like to despise, as these guys are worshiping God wrong. They're terrible people. Everyone should hate them. And he's saying, like, look, all these people you would expect to do good didn't do good, but the Samaritan stepped up. So the whole don't judge a book by its cover kind of crap. Like, it's literally an anti-racist argument. And yet Christians have been some of the most vicious racists in world history. So it's like the book itself isn't enough to change people, but it can if it can help people if it's used right. So it's neither good nor bad.
Yeah.
People tend to think that religion is going inherently to corrupt people, or it's going to save them and give them a good morality. And realistically, it doesn't do either. It's not really, it's not able to, because there's tons of other things that affect the way we think, not just the religion.
Yeah, and I think that brings us into what Rashi. So you're Palestinian and you're Muslim and you're living in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. You've had to live through a lot of these ups and downs as far as Islamophobia within the United States. It flares up, it goes away. Can you kind of go into what your life has been as a Palestinian Muslim growing up in your typical Midwestern setting?
Sure. So I would say like my first experiences with Islamophobia were around 9/11. I was still pretty young. I was about 10 years old, but I still remember an increase in violence against Muslims. I remember being scared to like go out with my mom because she wears the hijab, and I just remember the word like terrorist being thrown around, you know? And even though that was like sort of like a peak at that time, I feel like there's still always like a baseline of hate and fear towards Muslims in this country. Even like the idea that anytime a Muslim or even an Arab does something, it's automatically labeled as terrorism. You know, it's never like extremism. We never get that mental illness label. You know, the media always has to bring up the fact that they're Muslim, whereas like a Christian or someone else did something, you know, there's always sort of an excuse, or their religion never gets brought up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. A disturbed young man.
Right. whereas Muslims, it always, even if that person doesn't necessarily identify as Muslim or practice it, because, you know, in Islam, you can't do those things. Like to us, when we're watching it and we see like, you know, a Middle Eastern guy and he does something, we're like, oh my God, please don't be Muslim, please. Because we already know what the media is going to say. And we already know like, okay, like we're screwed right now, you know? So I feel like we're just constantly like fighting this stigma that Muslims are just like inherently violent people.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that you brought up the terms, the way that gets used, you know, the way that we tend to apply the term terrorism today almost exclusively to Muslims. Mm-hmm. And yet, gosh, I don't know, Latin America has historically produced far more terrorists than any other part of the world, but we tend to separate it entirely. And like, we don't think about this stuff. And we use these terms in really specific ways these days. And yeah, you've got all kinds of complete loons, you know, that are committing atrocities explicitly in the name of another religion. But if it's not Islam, you never mention it.
Yeah.
So we didn't talk much in the media about like Anders Breivik in Norway, who wanted to spark a new crusade and slaughtered a huge number of like, you know, people supporting Muslim immigrants and whatnot. And no one was really talking about this as a Christian terrorist, but that's what he was. Or one of the first things that really got me interested in the kind of terrorist ideologies, you know, was the Baruch Goldstein killings and the Ibrahimi Mosque back in 94. And I went much later in life back to that because I wanted to, you know, see if I could find any examples of anybody calling it terrorism, and no American newspaper did. But the dude was explicitly doing it in the name of wiping out Muslims to ensure Jewish supremacy in the West Bank. So he was a Jewish terrorist, but neither Jewish nor terrorist showed up in the reporting. It was just extremist. You know, what could drive him to this? You're speculating on the mental health of people. You know, you get all that, like you get a free pass in a sense, but we never give that to Muslims. So who was the guy that like, you know, I think it was a physician, but like on a military base or something that went around shooting people. Oh, I can't remember his name now. But, you know, they immediately focus, he's a Muslim. This Muslim.
Are you talking about the one in Fort Hood, Texas?
Yes, it was Texas. Yeah, I couldn't remember that. All the reporting on that was all mentioning his religion and trying to connect him to a general pattern of Islamic extremism. Nothing about, you don't get the same courtesy, you know, and so yeah, the story you bring up, you see that over and over. It's got to be so frustrating to have that applied to you, you know. So
yeah, well, and the two words Christian, you never hear the words Christian terrorist.
I mean, you never hear any religion being brought up in the media unless they're Muslim.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the Ku Klux Klan. What was the Ku Klux Klan?
Literally,
They're a terrorist organization who use their religion in their ideology to terrorize Black Americans and men and people of color in this country. It's political ideology, it's religious ideology, and they commit acts of terror. What more do you need in the definition to be, like, what I would love to sit with a member of the State Department and ask them, why is the Ku Klux Klan not a officially a, labeled as a terrorist organization? What's your reasoning? Give me, I mean, you got the history, you got the violence, you got the ideology.
Right.
What other ingredients you need to put in the pot to make that stew and make that to taste like terrorism?
Right,
you know?
Which we tend not to do to Christian groups in general in the U.S., no matter how extreme they are. You know, your soldiers of God type, you know, cult movements that are trying literally to train people to go out and blow up abortion clinics. And we don't talk about them as Christian terrorists. We talk about them as like anti-abortion extremists. Like, no, they're literally terrorists who are Christian. So hello, it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, we only tie this to Islam.
One of the most stupidest things I heard, one of the most stupidest terrorist attacks that happened in the United States was when that guy walked into a Sikh temple thinking that it was a mosque and shot them up, because in his ignorant mind, what he thought that Muslims wear turbans. I don't think I've ever seen a Muslim wear a turban for once.
But, not anymore. I mean,
not anymore. I mean, not since the days of Salah ad-Din, maybe.
I mean, like Turkic turbans or whatever. Yeah, but no, it's bizarre. I mean, and there's a whole bunch of those. Like, I saw. Like there was one where somebody like stopped him at a car, pulled this guy out of his car and beat him savagely. Well, he's a Sikh, but because he wore a turban, you know, it was one of those like towel head, you know, you got all those kind of stories. And yeah, I think some of it just comes from the enduring racist epithets too. So towel head. You know, make sure, even though, again, Muslims don't wear that headdress and haven't for centuries, but it's bizarre. But it's just a kind of weird reflexive racism. They're not really thinking, you know, I mean, but according, granted, I'm sure neither of these guys that we're both talking about had any idea what a Sikh is. So there's about this.
It just comes from like that, like I said, like that baseline fear of like Muslims or anyone that's different. Like all you need is to educate yourself. But instead of educating, they like build this fear inside of them, and then they just take it out. Because you never see Muslims in the media portrayed as anything. Like if a Muslim does something good, their religion is not brought up. It's only when they do something bad, you know. So if there was some kind of representation in the media in the United States, then there's this fear of like, oh my God, these like unknown, this religion, it has to be evil, it has to be bad because we don't know about it. They're not going to educate themselves. But it's just that problem that we only hear about Muslims when it's some extreme act, you know?
Yeah, media can help to sort of normalize people or an idea, look at increasing LGBT representation on television. That may have had some effect on like kids growing up and being less prone to like calling anything bad gay or whatever. But it on its own, I don't know that it'll help, especially since there's all kinds of great techniques they've come up with. Well, it's just a bunch of like woke shit, and they're like trying to force feed us and trying to like get us to accept blah 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 Muslims. You know, they're coming up with a way to reject, you know, Hollywood is a bunch of communists or whatever. So we do need to find ways to just get people to engage, accept, understand this stuff, because difference is the key. Like it's always difference. Islamophobia is a fear of people who are different than you in some way that you don't understand. In the same way that Judeophobia was. Judeophobia back in old Christian Europe was, these are a people that live near me, but they have practices that I don't understand. So there's something different about them. And as soon as you have a difference, you can introduce all of the weird bullshit, scary shit. You can make stuff up about them, you know, because difference is scary to some people. The people who are more likely to go and do their reading, though, they're the people who aren't as prone to that fear. How we reach the people who are naturally more prone to fear of difference and get them to really see that people aren't scary, it's a little harder. You know, media really helps the people who are naturally more open, you know, who, if you give them information, oh, okay, cool, and they'll grow up. But the people who are just prone to fear narratives in general, that, you know, the greater, like, you know, amygdala type responses, how do we how we actually reach people like that to make it less scary for them is that's the $10,000 question.
Well, no doubt Christianity has, at least in my opinion, has been the main number one, you know, suspect and culprit for establishing this very solid bedrock of Islamophobia that goes back centuries, you know, since the times of the Crusader period. So here we have this, you know, great, you know, titanium foundation of Islamophobia that has been built up over time. Now we think of ourselves as being modern intellectuals. We think ourselves as being progressives. We think of ourselves as having evolved past those days of barbarism and medieval thought. But in reality, just by viewing the sentiment surrounding Gaza on the pro-Israeli side, we're realizing, oh my God, we are not that much farther from the Crusader period as far as ideologies. And it's like, let's go back. Now we have to go back and reanalyze the past, I feel like, in order to understand where we're at now. So I kind of want, but before I do that, I want, Rashi, I want you to continue on throughout your life, if you can, on your experience as a Muslim American. What has it been like, just given your location, you know, where you're at and where you're at? You're in the heart of the United States. So you also had experience in going to Palestine and visiting Palestine. And I'm sure Islamophobia played a significant part of that experience. So if you don't mind of indulging us with that.
Yeah. So, like I said, just throughout my life, it's always like this just constant sort of Islamophobia, and it has its like rises every time something happens. For instance, like when Biden spoke about those fake 40 beheaded babies, and that 6-year-old boy was stabbed to death not far from me for being Muslim and Palestinian. And that, like, really, that one, like, really shook me to my core. I remember I was, like, scared to send my son to school. I, like, kept him home for a little bit. And it's just scary how, you know, some lie can take all these extremists and lead them to do these things. And, like, even after Biden put out that fake BS statement about, like, oh, you know, I condemn Islamophobia, whatever, it's very obvious to Muslims living in the United States that our government is, their loyalty to Zionism, like, far outweighs any support that they could have for the Muslim community. You know, like, you can't pretend to care about Muslims here while you're, like, actively killing them somewhere else. So, you know, that's just how it is for Muslim Americans. It's like, this constant, like, feeling of, like, you know, I don't want to say everyone's against us, but, like, they just don't understand. They're never going to take the time to look into the religion. As long as it's different from them, there's always going to be this hate there. So, like, when I was in Palestine, I mean, Palestine, obviously, it's Islamophobic, but it's, you don't even have to be Muslim, because, I mean, obviously there's Christian Palestinians, so their hate for Palestinians, they don't care about your religion. As long as you're Palestinian, they don't like you there, you know? From the moment you enter through security, it's, like, very well known that you're going to be sitting for hours. Whether or not, I mean, it's not like they're questioning you. They just put you on the side and you're going to sit for hours. When my husband went by himself, he sat for, like, 5 hours. Like, it's just it's, like, a known thing. If you're a Palestinian and you're going to visit Palestine, you're going to be sitting for hours and hours and hours just so that they can kind of, like, break you down and make you never want to come back and visit. So there's that. And then just being there, as beautiful as it was, there's still always this, like, fear that even though I'm an American, over there, they just see me as, like, Palestinian. They just see me as less than. And one of the experiences was we were actually driving to, I believe, Haifa, and we got stopped at a checkpoint. And we showed them our passports and all of that, and instead of just letting us through, they pulled our car to the side and very aggressively made us get out of the car, made us like wake up. My kids were both sleeping in the car. They made us like pop the trunk, pop the hood, like go into this separate room while I'm waking my kids up. I'm scared because to them I'm just Palestinian, and I already know the mentality of the IDF is like shoot first, ask questions later, right? So like any move you make, you're kind of like walking on eggshells. You don't know what's going to happen.
No.
Then they have their like guns pointed at my 4-year-old son. This is just like their mentality, you know what I mean? Like they don't care who you're, if it's like Palestinian, they think like automatically terrorist, or they can grow up to be terrorist. So that whole process, like they brought us into this room, they took all our pictures, like they had to document the whole thing. And then they eventually like let us leave. But it's just that like constant like fear. Like I'm afraid of being Palestinian in my own country because of the IDF and how they treat you. Like I said, yeah, Muslim, it's worse, but Christian Palestinians get the same treatment.
Yeah. I've per in the early days, when I mean by early days, I mean like 3 months ago on TikTok Lives, when you and I would go and debate Zionists. By the way, those days were fun, Rashi. I miss those days. But
I don't have it in me anymore.
I feel you. I took a break for a month, not out of choice. I just got distracted with things in my personal life. I had to, like the getting married and the holiday season, and I missed going on the lives. But when I was on there, there's some interesting discussions you and I had. We were very good at, I believe, tag teaming, like in the WWE when we go on these lives, like it was. And one time there was a, I don't know if you remember this. Do you remember the British guy that was spewing a lot of Islamophobic tropes at you? And he was very disrespectful. Ironically, there's two people stood up for you, myself, who I'm a pro-Palestinian Christian, and actually a pro-Israel redneck Jewish guy in, I think it was in Tennessee or something like that. And he stood up for you by the disrespect aimed at you. And it was interesting to see those dynamics play out on live. And that guy that, I don't know if you remember, do you remember that guy? The British guy who
I
was
remember.
throwing all these insults. Yeah. Now, I went in on him, I went to town, and that was very satisfying. I'm not gonna lie. There's a sadistic side of me that was very satisfied with how I went to town on him after that. But at the same time, I think back on it and I'm like, I can't really judge him because I have to look back at that 14-year-old, And I thought to myself, wait a minute, I used to do the same thing. And in telling that story about that Muslim lady who came to our public high school to educate us, here's what really sucks about that is I'll never be able to apologize to her. I'll never see her again. I don't even know what her name was. This was like back in 2003, 2004-ish. I'll never know who she is. And therefore, I refuse to forgive myself for that behavior, because my rule of thumb is if I am not able to personally apologize to somebody for my behavior and I missed that opportunity, then I will not forgive myself for it. I will keep it as a scar on my heart, and as a reminder, rather than forget it and try to forgive myself and move on. I will not do that. And I will never be able to apologize to that woman. And I'm deeply ashamed of it. And I will not put it aside. I'm not going to say, ah, it's in the past. No, I need to remember that moment and teach and use it to help people like that British guy who was hounding you and throwing out all kinds of Islamophobic statements, insulting your prophet, insulting your book, because I can keep that as a reminder to better understand jackasses like that, So when now I know that that was just one incident that I personally saw, directed at you, but I know you have a lot more stories to tell on that. And I would like for you, if you could, go into that. I know it's kind of traumatizing. I know you have to reopen some old mental wounds by going into it. But if you're able to do it, could you go into all the things that you've experienced going on these TikTok lives? You're very patient. I noticed that you are a very patient person. You never lose your cool. And you never resort to ad hominem attacks or attacking anybody else's religion. You definitely get passionate. You definitely get angry, and frustrated. But nonetheless, you have been very good at. And honestly, I feel like so many in the audience were able to relate to you not because you're Muslim or Palestinian, but because you're a typical Midwestern mom, just speaking from the heart. So I felt like you had an amazing effect on the audience, despite the fact that you're not some big social media influencer. In some ways, you've been having a lot more influence than you realize because of the fact that you're just a regular person. You talk like a regular person, but you're also very patient. So if you can go into some of that to give the audience a little bit of perspective of the things that you've had to deal with.
Yes. So. You know, like, since this conflict escalated in October, I feel like it's given all these, like, anti-Arab, anti-Muslims confidence to kind of now openly spread Islamophobia. It's like they've crawled out from under their rocks, and they're ready to join, like, the pro-Israel movement based on the fact that they just hate Muslims, you know? They know nothing about the conflict other than they're like, oh, Arabs, terrorists, Muslims, like, yeah, we're not on their side, you know? And those are the people that come up and try to debate you just because they feel like, you know, they're like welcomed with open arms by this pro-Israel Zionist community. And they want to be able to openly spread their hate and just kind of beat up on a Muslim to feel better about themselves. But to be honest, like, yeah, obviously it upsets me, but at the end of the day, I feel bad for them because their hate of another religion, like they hate my religion, I feel like, more than they love theirs. I've never ever felt like I needed to compare my religion to someone else's. Like, I feel like my faith in my own religion takes care of what I need it to, you know? I feel like it shows lack of faith in their own religion by coming up there so angry and so full of hate, you know, towards me. It's like, yeah, I can debate them, but at the end of the day, it's kind of like a waste of time. They just need that space to, like I said, like, unleash all these feelings that they've kept inside, and now they feel like, oh, you know, Muslims in the media again, like, yeah, now suddenly I'm pro-Israel, I'm a Zionist now, just so that I can openly hate Arabs, hate Muslims.
And it would be interesting to know how many of these same guys, on when they're having their, you know, water cooler talk, spew anti-Semitic stuff.
Oh, of course.
It'd be interesting to know that. I mean, there'd be no way to prove it, but right. I'm just going to place a bet here on the table with my chips that a lot of these Islamophobic guys that are suddenly pro-Israel,
they're not pro-Jewish, I'll tell you that much.
They're not pro-Jewish. They're Judeophobic. And by the way, Doc, I really liked how we kind of set a good precedent in one of our episodes by normalizing the word Judeophobic as opposed to as anti-Semitic, as if anti-Semitism is a special type of racism. Racism is racism. Islamophobia, right. Judeophobia, you know, it's Afrophobia. Well, I mean, it's all part of the same monster. Don't feel like it, you know, it has some type of special category. You can put one in and ignore the other ones. They all come from the same point of evil in our universe, in my opinion.
No, they do. And it's interesting that, well, humans in general are just not really good at nuance. And I would have preferred that we left the term anti-Semitism to a distinct form of racist nationalism tied into, you know, 19th century race science, because that's why it was invented. That's why it was used. But it now is just a catch-all for anybody who doesn't like Jews. But there's historically different reasons for that. The chief one, and the one that overlaps the most with this fear of Islam, is the phobia, which is rooted in just a fear of difference. I mean, look at the word xenophobia, right? I mean, fear of difference, you know, fear of the alien. And that's what we're talking about here with Judeophobia and Islamophobia, is these people have distinct different practices from me, therefore I'm afraid of them. That's the core issue for a lot of people. For some, it's theological, so anti-Judaism. For some, it used to be like a hardcore racism. That's less common outside of like straight up neo-Nazi circles that still believe that shit. For most people, it really just is a fear of difference. And once you don't know something about a particular group, you can start believing all kinds of inane horseshit about them. I mean, mm-hmm. I had somebody recently just on Instagram that, I mean, actually two different people said that they never knew what the blood libel really was, you know, and it always kind of comes up around this time of year because, you know, when it's got started in Europe centuries back, it was this idea that they're killing Christian children to make Passover matzah, that they need like sacrificial blood for it. And we're heading toward Passover here. But it's just,
I mean, if that's the case, then matzah, they Christian babies must not taste that good because matzah is pretty bland.
It's bland flavor. As hell. Yeah. It's
So, I mean, if that's what Christian babies taste like, I don't know.
But it's the root for it is people just didn't know anything about it. I mean, if you knew anything about it, if those Europeans had ever even tasted matzah, they would know it's nonsense, but they haven't, and it doesn't matter. And no one's going to go say, hey, give me a piece of that. I want to try it. And no one's going to try that because it works because of the ignorance. I mean, hell, if you knew the slightest thing about Jewish ritual practices, consumption of blood is like straight up forbidden. So how could you use blood, much less like blood from a non-kosher animal like humans, but you're not supposed to consume blood, period. But what makes it work is that you don't know. There's that ignorance that it can thrive from. And that's where there's a huge overlap with what we're talking about with. So to me, Islamophobia and Judeophobia, they're exactly the same thing. It's just a fear of difference. And at this point, Judeophobia is simply less of a problem for a lot of people, although it still exists as an issue, but you know, Jews are simply better known in the US. So unless you're some hardcore loon, for most people, Jews aren't particularly threatening or different anymore. I mean, it's helpful to understand still for people, there are more Jews in the US than in Israel. I mean, there's a lot of representation. So the fear isn't as potent here, where you still see a lot of it in more isolated rural areas, you know, rural parts of Europe, things like that, where it's never really gone away at all. But Islamophobia is much more potent because it's a growing population in the US. There's more and more Muslim immigrants as well as converts to Islam here, and people just don't know a damn thing about it. So you can use the same psychological techniques.
Okay, so we've covered the psychological reasons for Islamophobia amongst the commoners, the peasants, which are all of us, by the way, unless you're in the top 0.01%. But so now I want to shift gears to the political reasons for Islamophobia. I want to do this in the format of presenting a hypothesis to you, Dr. Liam. We discovered something unknowingly during these podcasts, and I was thinking about it. I'm like, wait a minute, this is kind of a new way of doing podcasts and just in discourse, where I would present to you a hypothesis, which, by the way, thank you for that word. I've known that word, but in one of your lives, you corrected me when I said theory, and you said that everything's a theory. With the word that you mean to say is hypothesis. So ever since then, I've been learning, Doc. I take notes. I may be a dumbass, but I know how to take notes sometimes. So I have a hypothesis I would like to present to you concerning the political power structure reasons for Islamophobia. And it has to do with capitalism, and it has to do with imperialism, obviously. And here it goes, you know. And you can critique it. You can concur with it, whatever you want. But here it is. So the reason I believe that the system is at direct odds with Islam is because the tenets of Islam at their very core are a complete threat to the world system. And here's what I mean. Some of the tenets within Islam, if they you know, given the fact that Islam is the fastest growing religion on the planet and growing, and it's happening organically. It's not like Muslims are riding in through hordes on, like you said, on horses and getting people to convert at the sword or they get beheaded. No, it's happening because people are willingly converting to Islam. Now, in Islam, you have some very threatening ideologies. And I want to go into those very threatening ideologies. One of them being the opposition to compounding interest. In Islam, compounding interest is considered haram. It's sinful. The entire base of capitalism is built on compounding interest. So that alone right there makes it a threat to the capitalist system. Also, you have environmentalism. Within Islam, you have many tenets that speak on behalf of the environment. You shouldn't cut down a tree. Not to mention, it's the what's the Arabic term, Rashi, for taking care of the earth? Or, I forgot. I should have had my notes prepared. But it's the idea that, you know, Allah gave this planet to us as a gift, and we should be good stewards of it for the sake of our generation and future generations. There is a word for it. And sorry, audience, I should have had this in my notes. I'm going to get slaughtered in the comments section for not having this prepared. There's also the rules of war in jihad. Very specific rules of war. You should not kill the elderly. When somebody surrenders, you won't kill them. Very much similar to the NATO rules of engagement. Islam has these rules in jihad about this. You shall not kill children. Rape, of course, is haram. So you have these very, very strict directions of morality. And these strict tenets within Islam are spreading at a huge, you know, at a very fast rate throughout the planet. And these things in and of themselves threaten the capitalist system that has enslaved us economically, socially, you know, psychologically. So, of course, Islamophobia is going to be one of the core elements of this capitalist imperialist system we have. It's a threat to it. So that's why I believe there's a particular attention that they put into and an investment to spread Islamophobia throughout our media, throughout the psychology of, throughout the industrial psychology, psychologies of our democratic systems. So, Doc, there's my hypothesis. As dumb as it sounded, the way I said it, I'm sure, I'm going to present that before you for your, academic, analyses.
Okay. It makes sense on some levels, especially if you're looking at the more educated people who are still concocting reasons to hate. But I think that what's actually driving it is a lot simpler, especially since most people aren't really aware of any of this stuff, even the ones who are involved in stoking that kind of hate from, you know, the political heights. They often really don't know these things. So I really think that it's more a matter of the differences being useful to power structures than anything else. Especially since if you think about, okay, so you mentioned usury and the problem around there, right? But Islamic banks have all found ways around it and of still making money. They just call it fees or whatever. They levy certain fees. So it's not like they're not able to do exactly the same thing. And realistically, the beginnings of capitalism as we understand it as an economic system are in the Islamic Middle Ages. I mean, there's always been more of an openness to merchant activity. I mean, the fact that was Muhammad's job kind of makes it, you know, kind of normal and easy. So there's a lot. There was a number of really important banking innovations that Muslims did that then influenced all the European banks that ultimately created the foundations of capitalism.
From my understanding, these systems that, you know, that came about in Islamic societies in the past, Islam was no doubt an influence in these things. So the predatory capitalism that we see today that we're all victims of, and we can all see just in basically everybody's watching this, their economic situation, I'm betting that 90% of them, you know, have something to say about, you know, how it's affected their lives. But it's the predatory capitalism that was, it's very much opposed in Islam through its tenets.
Well, yeah. In the religion, sure, but that, again, that's also true for Christianity, if you want to look at it in the in religious terms. And yet Christians have no problem being predatory capitalists.
Right.
And certainly there are plenty of Muslims who are as well. And, you know, look at a lot of the oligarchies spread across the Mideast and just how comfortable they are with massive wealth accumulation, even though there's a strong scriptural basis for saying this is wrong, that you shouldn't do this, yeah, right? That you should be like giving all that stuff back. They have no problem accumulating all this shit and, you know, building their big palaces and collecting their cars or whatever else. So
what's interesting about that is what you're talking about in the Middle East is that's a very much the talk of the town down there, is that I hear every talk that I have with Muslims living in the Middle East, they're saying that our aristocratic societies above us are acting very haram. Like you talk about the kingdom over Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is supposed to be the custodian of Islam, quote unquote. And so Saudis are complaining that, look, we're going in contrary to Islam right now. We got to stop. So that's the talk of the town amongst the general population.
Yeah, and criticism of neoliberalism, of the kleptocracies. I mean, why were people so upset about, I mean, one of the issues that helped to touch off the uprising in Egypt was that Mubarak would have put his son in power, and his son was one of these crony capitalists. And so he didn't have the kind of respect that, you know, as much as they disliked him, at least Mubarak had a military background or whatever, but his son did not. His son was out of this capitalist class. There's a lot of criticism of that. But honestly, that was true in Christianity as well. If you look back at the kind of homegrown populism in the U.S. in the 19th century, it was suffused with Christianity. I mean, think about William Jennings Bryan's, cross of gold kind of speech there. I mean, he was like a fundamentalist Christian, and yet also opposed to the predatory capitalist class. They were linked together. The transformation of American evangelicalism to being hyper-capitalistic and comfortable with that, it took a long time. And the danger here is that over time, this kind of stuff can be normalized in the Muslim world as well, because there are deeper social forces that push that along. But yeah, exactly the same kind of criticisms you're seeing today among Muslims, they were very common among Christians in the 19th and early 20th century. They've just gone away. Well, at least partly they've gone away entirely, but they're much less significant now than a lot of the popular resistance among Muslims to this kind of accumulation.
But we're touching now on Christianity, which has been on the, my top bullet points here. I obviously grew up in the evangelical community. My parents were not necessarily evangelical, but because my dad was military and we were constantly traveling, we'd have to find a local church. And oftentimes it would be these mega, evangelical churches. So that obviously had a huge influence on me. Since then, since my time in living in Palestine, however, that's when my belief system completely shifted. And I would say that my walk in my faith and searching to find my, the faith that I really hold to this day was the result of Palestinians in that walk and how Islam actually, I incorporate so many elements of Islam into my belief system as well as Judaism. So when I was living in Jerusalem, I was studying Judaism and I was learning about Islam through my friends. And those two things kind of melded into my belief system to the point where, I guess where I'm going with that is this adaptation I had with Islam and its tenets and comparing to what I see the propaganda spewed by Christians, it begs the question of like the history of this. And it obviously goes back a long ways. So therefore I want to get into with you, Doc, the old school Islamophobia that we've seen centuries past. especially with Christianity. I want to take a baseball bat and beat up Christianity for a good minute, because I have a lot of personal vendettas against Christianity because of how it, you know, deceived me and filled me up with a lot of Islamophobic propaganda, when Islam is actually what kind of brought me closer to my faith as a Christian. So I have that personal vendetta against Western Christianity, and I want to go into how insane it got back then, where it started, when we saw the first rises of it, and also how that same machinery of militant Christianity was directed at Jews and Muslims at the same time, to the point where Muslims and Jews often had to rely on each other for protection and for mutual benefit against this horde of what I call militant Christianity that is, in my opinion, the mainstream of this day.
Well, just first on the your earlier hypothesis, I think that there's a part of that that is definitely right that we should come back to later, and that is the connection to capital, as well as to the nation state. I think that a lot of the modern political forms where it is most normalized in political discourses and leads to, you know, bombings and everything else has a lot to do with capital and the nation state, and the people who are within the Muslim world that they're willing to like roll with that kind of crap. Those are the ones that, you know, so-called Western countries love. But you know, the Muslims you're talking about that are critical of that sort of thing, and people, there's a very strong social justice component in Islam that I think a lot of Westerners are not really aware of. You know, the whole take care of widows and orphans. If you're well off, you got to pay more in to support the community. All these things are very, very important. There's a kind of anti-racist element too in the concept of like the ummah and the sort of diversity that's described in Quran. God created all this diversity. Who are you to question all that? You know. So there are places where, as nationalism was spreading in the 19th and 20th century, it was actually very controversial in the Muslim world, because a lot of people argued that nationalism was inherently un-Islamic, and yet in the long run, it's still sunk in. So there are still are critiques, but there's also a tremendous amount of nationalism that currently exists among Muslims, where you go back to the, you know, the spread in the 19th century, and people were just like, what the hell is this crap? This has nothing to do with us. Over time, it still normalizes the idea. So the structural components, the structural features of capitalism and the nation state are very important to the modern political dimensions of Islamophobia that you were talking about earlier. But I don't think it's as sophisticated as looking at the specific features of Islam that are viewed as a threat. I think just the core psychology, it's different. And that's threatening enough. But the features that, where it does contradict it, where Islam does conflict with the concept of the nation state or capital, those are worth discussing, because at the end of the day, those really are a lot of the driving force, you know, in our modern political Islamophobia. So we can come back to that if you want, because in terms of your hypothesis, I'm partly in agreement with it. And we can build on that. But as far as like the earlier roots, so where does Islamophobia come from? Its origins really are at the very beginning of it, in the same way that the Christian hatred of Jews is, you know, is pretty early, it baked into the faith pretty early on. As soon as Islam shows up, there are criticisms of it. But the criticisms are quite varied early on. For most Christians, Islam was simply viewed as a heresy. And the most common word in European languages wasn't Islam at all. It was, you know, Mohammedanism. You know, they thought that they worshipped Muhammad, that it was somebody claiming a later savior that kind of like supplanted it. And therefore, it was viewed as a heretical movement that needed to be combated. But people didn't take this sort of... educated people didn't take a kind of civilizational view of Islam as fundamentally different. So this idea that there is a conflict between Islam and the so-called West, that's a very modern idea. That doesn't start showing up until the early modern period. You look at early medieval and medieval Islam, that you have two main reactions people are going to have. If they're educated European Christians, then they viewed Islam as a heresy coming from a very advanced civilization that was ultimately, you know, the same basis of, you know, European civilization, but Muslims were definitely better off. They were richer, more technologically sophisticated, but they weren't understood to be a completely different culture. They weren't separated from the so-called West because the concept didn't exist yet. But the less educated would simply have the phobic response. This is different. This is weird, if they encountered it at all. And that was early on just less common. So the discourses around Islamophobia, if you go back into the medieval, they're very different from what we run into today, because it's mostly very educated Europeans who encounter the Muslim world, and they have a tremendous amount of respect for it. But ordinary people didn't encounter it. They might be more willing to hear about Jews in their environment, because Muslims simply didn't live in most of Europe until the modern period. They were in relatively tiny numbers, relatively isolated parts of it. Certain areas, yes, but you didn't have Muslims wandering around in Hamburg, you know, in the 12th century. They just weren't there. So it wasn't something that people really interacted with. But the scholars writing at the time were incredibly complimentary of it on civilizational levels, critical mm-hmm. of it from in religious terms. So there's a theological dispute that builds up there.
Now, there was obviously points in history, in European history, where the power structures, the elites, wanted to mobilize Christians against Muslims for sheer power grabs. So they had to weaponize these ignorances that you're talking about amongst the population. And because obviously the elites were probably educated, and they knew that Islam was probably a beautiful religion and it has a lot of positive tenets. Obviously, somebody who's that evil in power doesn't really care about that. They just want to, knowing that what they're feeding the population is a lie, and knowing they will be effective. Can we go into a little bit of that about how they weaponize these ignorances against the commoners, like we see our power structures doing to us today, and, you know, being complicit with the genocide in Gaza?
Well. Yeah, there are definitely periods where you manipulate an ignorance of it, you spread fear around it. There's quite a few spots along the way, and it isn't just like the Crusader period, although obviously there's plenty of it there. The kind of reflexive hatreds that were stoked in the Crusader period honestly also folded in Jews and Eastern Christians. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of violence that comes along in that way, but it's not terribly sophisticated in terms of the propaganda. The way that you stoke hate today is in some ways a bit more clever. This is why when people actually spent time around Muslims in the Crusader period, it tended to fade away pretty fast. A lot of Crusaders that stayed in the area tended to go native, which is why a lot of them just blended into those communities. They became part of like the local Middle Eastern Christian populations as well. But the most Crusaders did just go home right afterwards. They didn't stay. So they didn't have the long-term exposure to or interaction with it. The kind of just simplistic hatreds that were stoked at the time, they were honestly pitched much more in the theological terms, in very simple ways. These guys are heretics. You know, they're replacing Jesus with this other person, and we have to attack them. They're satanic or whatever. And that stuff falls apart very, very quickly for people once they actually encountered Muslims. And we've got a lot of interesting stories that survive, you know, accounts from the Crusader era of those interactions.
Can you give us one example of that?
One of the things that made it more complicated for a lot of people in the Crusader era itself was the continuing political differences and the fights that build up there. So it's more stuff that comes down to us through interaction among the people who generally were curious. So you have, for example, all kinds of discussions between, well, Muslim physicians are an interesting one, I think, because they're going to see the Crusaders and what they're doing. Oh yeah, they're like sawing this guy's leg off because he got injured in battle, but there was no need to it at all. They understood the medicine better. And then you have interactions with them, and the next thing you know, you have some Europeans who are now curious about it, and they go and they start studying it. You know, you get you end up with people like Adelard of Bath, who goes down and spends time among, you know, the Arabs and starts learning from them and brings a lot of that stuff back. And in the long run, the Crusades ultimately helped to create the European university system. You know, all the Enlightenment stuff that eventually created the scientific revolution started with putting European Christians in direct contact with Muslims. So while the political structures kept teaching hate and fear and, hey, let's ally with the Mongols and we can all wipe these Muslims out, they're bad people, the people on the ground that are experiencing this end up picking up enough stories to inspire a huge amount of interest in going to the region, reading their books. So, I mean, the way universities built up in Europe, you start looking, you know, the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, as universities are beginning to be founded all over the place, they all have Arabic departments where they're translating new books in every year to introduce into the curriculum. They have to take them from Arabic to Latin to do that, but that's what they're doing. That really starts with a lot of this direct contact between people, because it makes it harder to believe the bullshit about it, you know, and you get curious and you start interacting. So there's always like there's a human difference, I guess. Some people, if they're faced with a difference and they start interacting and see it, you can break through that bullshit that you've heard because you're naturally more interested and more open. And next thing you know, you're studying it, where other people stay in that fear-driven mode. And for them, it's easier to stay, you know, in the hardcore hater camps, you know? So those are the people who wanted to think, well, Christianity needs to wipe these people out. Let's convert the Mongols. Let's pile on them. Let's just destroy this people. Ah, because you want that land. But it actually had a huge, huge impact on the development of the modern world. I mean, realistically, the scientific revolution doesn't make a damn bit of sense without that contact with the Muslim world, because the Muslim world was a direct linear heir to a lot of the classical developments in Greco-Roman civilization, as well as compiling tons of important medical and scientific data from Persians, from Egyptians, everybody else. You're pulling all this material together, and it all exists in Arabic, so it's there. I mean, they're already studying this stuff. And then Europeans start interacting and engaging in that environment. So the kind of hate you're running into, again, it's a little different than in the contemporary world, because the elites were often less Islamophobic and less interested in stoking Islamophobia, and more interested in talking about the advantages, the benefits, the things that the Muslims were really, really good at. You know, and it was a lot of the just reflexive fear or hatred or the theological stuff. So it's a heresy kind of arguments. It doesn't take on the dimensions that we would think of today as the racist Islamophobia until you get into the early modern period. So there's a significant shift later in the way that elites deal with it. But early on, they really only have the theological complaints. And then once they start engaging, it oftentimes changes their mind. So it's a much more complicated dynamic earlier on.
Yeah, I'm a prime example of that when I went to Palestine, when I went to Jerusalem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if people who naturally at least have the potential to be more open, and then you put them in that environment, it's going to change perspectives. So your experience is a lot like that of tons of other people who went off on these crusades and then spent time around people and then either brought ideas back that started changing things and inspiring, you know, new types of thought, or they just stay. If the ones they stayed in the area, some of them, again, they just went native. This is why there are occasional blue-eyed blondes that show up in Lebanon and Palestine, you know, because there were tons of like Germanic peoples from the Crusades that just, they stayed in the area, you know, and just married in and became, you know, local Christians, you know, local, you know, Catholic, you know, the tons of the local Catholic churches. So it gets harder when the hate is based on the religion. This is one of the reasons I think that the theological issues aren't ultimately the main drivers for this, because that's a little harder to sustain through direct contact. The more you know about it, the more you recognize that these three religions have a lot more in common than they have different. while they do have differences, those differences are not so extreme that it would naturally support the kind of radical hatreds. You know, at least if you're educated enough about the religions, if you spend the time talking to people and learning about them. So they had to find other reasons to sustain that hate, to maintain the competition, to keep the fighting going. So it does start to change in the early modern period rather markedly. But in the Middle Ages, it's a lot weirder process. It isn't exactly the same in terms of the way we'd see it today, you know?
It's interesting you bringing that up about how, you know, the theological differences break down very quickly, and in talking about how much more they have in common than they do different, than they have difference with each other. And I'll even take that further on a personal note, is that with me, I would say that getting close to Islam has gotten me closer to Christianity, simply due to the fact that the cultivation of Islam very much so was Middle Eastern. It's been maintained as Middle Eastern, and Christianity is a Middle Eastern religion. So they were the caretakers of that Middle Eastern traditions, the way of living, not just like the theological things, but just the way of living on a day-to-day basis. Like, the thing about Muslims is that they're uncompromising. And when it comes to theologically, most of them are very uncompromising. They maintain that wall that keeps the reverence of Allah intact, keeps the reverence of the Tanakh, the Torah intact, and even the teachings of Jesus. See, Muslims revere the teachings of Jesus, in my opinion, far more than Western Christians. Western Christians tend to more or less emphasize the letters of Paul. The letters of Paul are obvious, are mostly, you know, exemplified and preached and quoted more than the words of Jesus. Whereas in Islam, it's the complete opposite. They constantly quote Jesus because to them, he's a revered prophet. And thereby, in some type of way, Islam has maintained a more Christian way of living than Christians have, by simply that mechanism of, you know, revering these prophets, revering their words as being, you know, holy and put on a pedestal and protected and not being compromising in that. So that's where I take that a little further on a personal note, just from my own theological level, you know, which is why I appreciate your opinion, because you don't come at this from a theological perspective or a religious perspective. You're not religious. You come at this from a very pragmatic approach. So the combination of the two confirms basically the same thing that you're saying. You know, it complements each other.
Right. Yeah. It's less that they retain a kind of Christian perspective, but more a respect for the teachings that would have informed the very earliest Christian communities. Christianity as a religion is quite severely criticized in Islam, but it's the core beliefs, the ideas of Yeshu that were the ones that that were commonly attributed to him by the time you get into the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries. Those are fundamental elements of Islam, and it leaves out a lot of, for what ends up shaping Christianity more than anything else is its interaction with the Roman world. As it starts moving through the Roman upper classes, moving from, you know, an obscure movement among Jews, spreading outward into the diaspora, and then it brings in tons of working class people in the Roman world, and then from there slowly works its way up into the ruling classes, it ends up adopting tons of beliefs, rituals, perspectives that are informed by that Roman environment and leaving behind its Levantine Jewish origins. They do change the basic character of it in some ways. It does lose a lot of the social elements. The fact that Islam really emphasizes a social justice component, if you're looking at especially the preaching from the Meccan period of Islam's development, social justice is a really core component of it, and so is it in the preaching of Jesus. But you lose some of that later because of Christianity's accommodation to the power structures. In the same way that by the time you get to medieval and early modern Islam, a lot of Muslim power structures, you know, have affected the religion in some ways, and they begin to downplay those social justice components. When people interact with a lot of Muslims today, you're benefiting from some significant modern revival movements that have pushed people back to that. Say, hey, look at what we cared about before. These are really important, where their elites had also drifted away from it, because the interests of power do tend to downplay social justice components in favor of a status quo. And that does end up happening in both cases. But Christianity does take on some distinct differences because of the Roman interaction that lose some of the very distinctly Levantine Jewish elements of Jesus' teaching. And Islam, because it comes from the same region and interacted directly with Jews and Christians of that region, not of Western Europe, it took in those ideas much more directly.
Yes. And I want to circle back to that later on, and I'm going to bring up the House of Wisdom in Baghdad. But before I do that, I want to go into the ignorances surrounding Islam, the simple ignorances that I want to crush right now at the bud. I want to address these common tropes that are thrown at Muslims within Western Islamophobia. And Rashi, I'm going to need your help in that, because it would not be appropriate for me to start listing them. It would be more appropriate for you to do so, because I've seen these tropes directly spewed at you from these assholes on TikTok lives who go on here thinking that they basically go on here as the 14-year-old me. Again, I'm trying to stay away from judging. It's part of me trying to hold to my religion right now and not judging. But Rashi, could you start going through? Could we start picking these apart a little bit, if you don't mind?
Can I actually ask me what while you guys start diving into that? I'll be able to hear most of it, but do you mind if I go and refill my drink, do a couple of
things? Oh yeah. By the way, I forgot. We got to do a pet break. We start to make a tradition out of these little intermissions with our pets, if you don't mind. So I'm going to introduce you to another furry friend of mine when we come back. So
yeah, let's
take a little break.
We got to take a break overall, or you guys can start into this and start listing some of the thoughts and while I walk around and, heat up some coffee and things like that.
No, we can take a break. Rashi, do you mind taking a break? And
that's fine.
Are you still available for the next however long we go on?
Yeah.
Awesome. Cause my bladder is about to go all over the place. So, all right, guys.
Break time.
See you soon.